I'm Britta Phillips.
And I am Dean Wareham.
I think the only thing I can use here is that colloquial expression, everything old is new again. That was when I got the phone call and saying, do you want to do the interview? That's what was captivating to me is how, quote, current some of the things you're doing are. But then a lot of the things that you do, and we'll get deep into this, whether it's the covers, whether it's Warhol, whether it's Galaxy 500, is based on this firm grasp of living history. It's not nostalgia, but it's history that you're taking and you're moving it forward in many ways and doing new things with it.
Right. Well, hopefully you're right. I mean, I think there was a point in music. You know, Simon Reynolds wrote this book about post-punk. I don't know if you read it. What's it called?
Rip It Up and Start Again.
And it covers 1978 to 84. And then he stops there because he postulates that in music, at that right around that point, people started turning backwards a little, mining the past more. And that doesn't mean that you're aping the past. A lot of bands do that too, obviously. But drawing inspiration from that. And well, that was a long time ago now.
Part of the thing for me that's really interesting about what you're doing is you're helping in a big way, and I know you can't take the claim to this, but new generations of people are discovering. I mean, I was upstairs, you know, right near your dressing room last night, you know, to the left of the stage, and I was just, I spend 50% of my time watching you and 50% of my time watching the audience. And, you know, you had the oldsters in the front that knew every single word. And then right next to them was their way too young girlfriend who was going, so tell me about this.
Yes, right? We do get that a lot. We get people saying, my boyfriend won't stop talking to me about Luna or Galaxy. He brought me along and I loved it. or last night in Santa Cruz, there was a woman who had seen the Luna documentary, Tell Me, Do You Miss Me? And she had gone backwards from that and was now, you know, had gotten the Luna records and the Dean and Britta and now the Galaxy 500, and she brought her son with her too.
Wow. Yeah, all both directions and sideways. Whenever I ask Dean, what kind of music do we play? Because we get asked that and I always forget what to say. And he said, it's just, you know, classic rock.
Now, the idea of doing the Galaxy, we're going to kind of go, not necessarily in order of appearance, but bounce all over the place. But we'll start with Galaxy because it's relevant. That started in Spain, did it not?
It did. We had a Spanish promoter say, why don't you come over to my small festival and do one night of Dean and Britta, and then the next night do all Galaxy 500 songs. And we did that, and it was with this same band, the same drummer. It sounded really good, and though we still haven't been paid for that show, it's paying off now because we came back and we thought, you know, that's a good idea, and we should do more of these now that we've learned the songs. And of course, it's 20 years roughly since all those records were first released, and they've all been re-released and got a lot of attention this time. It's funny because it's not the first time they were re-released. They were re-released by Ryko Disc in the 90s because they'd been out of print. But this time got more attention.
So one of the things that I read and then I witnessed it last night is you said that you wanted to do these songs while you could still sing the high notes.
That is true. Yes, and one journalist was asking us, have you dropped the keys on any of these? And no, we haven't. And it was actually, I would say when I did it in January, it was difficult. And after a couple songs singing really high, I would just turn around and cough. I'd be up there on stage coughing. But
I don't warm up or anything. You know? I think, yeah, you're singing better and better. You don't have any problems hitting those high notes.
So some of the songs are really simple in chord structure, but one of the things that I heard you say is still it took a lot of rehearsal to get the new four-piece to really, you know, these are... You said it last night. You said, "Oh, there's only one verse in these songs, but
right.
but these are still pretty." And I want you to talk about these are pretty darn. You know, I was watching you play them, and you were concentrating.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you had this. You were having fun, but you had this very. I could watch your brain going, "Okay, then."
Yeah. Well, they're very specific. The drums and the bass, you know, are very specific parts. They're arranged, and I really wanted to learn, you know, what was recorded, and then maybe, you know, take a few liberties at the end of songs, maybe go to the low notes.
So many bands go in these days and they do one of two things. They either have a week in the studio because they have no money.
Right.
And you know the result of that. That's a guaranteed result. Or they go in with a killer producer, but they have no idea how to work with that person. So the whole concept of arranging, it's not that it's a lost art, but again, back to our friends in 1977, whether you're talking about the Heads or the Underground, you know, whoever you're talking about, these were arrangers. This was not subtle, you know, it all seemed very loose, but it wasn't.
Right. Well, I think there's always someone in the band, because you arrange not only the records, but you have to rearrange things for the live performance, and there's always... I'm actually not very good at that. Britt is better at that than I am, and in Luna it was sort of Justin who would say, well, you know what, I think this should go here, there, or that. He just had a better sense of what to say to the drummer than I did.
But also, I mean, Luna and Galaxy 500, you rehearsed a lot. You know, that's how the arrangements were worked out. You rehearse and rehearse, and you don't, at rehearsal, you don't just play loud. You play and listen to everybody else so that you figure out where to play and where not to play.
Okay, young bands in the audience, listen to that last line. You don't just play loud. Because, you know, volume makes up for absolutely nothing in the long run. So one of the things that was really fascinating to me is back in the day, you got to do some John Peel sessions.
Yes.
And those were different times than, oh, we're doing a, you know, and I'm on public radio, so I can say this, you know, we're doing an AOL session and we're going to make sure that you, you know, or even the casual day trotter sessions that aren't really as casual as they're supposed to be.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I remember the first Peel session for us in Galaxy 500, because we were overwhelmed. We looked at this gigantic studio where they have, you know, orchestras, and it was the first I'd ever seen of like a computerized tape machine where they mark the verse and chorus. And the engineer was Dale. Dale, his nickname is Boffin. He was the drummer in Mott the Hoople. And he was a bit cranky. We didn't have much time, but you had sort of 4 hours to record and then 4 hours to mix. And in between, you went and had tea at the BBC. And
incredible.
It was great.
Incredible. So do you think... that, and they continue on the kind of the same track of where things are, do you think that, you know, you were talking about how the Galaxy 500 stuff is doing really well out of nowhere. If this stuff was released back, I mean, how many records, it's a question within a question, but how many records did you actually sell back then? You know, because everybody's talking about the death of the music industry and nobody's selling anything. But I mean, this is a band, you know, or Luna. I mean, if you add up all of the records you've sold, all of the records you've sold, what would you say that number is?
700,000.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. All of the records on 22 years, right?
Probably the biggest Luna seller has probably sold 120,000. I don't really know for Galaxy 500 because it's been on different different labels, and but I still think it's probably easier to sell even, you know, in 1989. I think it was probably easier to sell records than it is now. There's so many more records coming. There's probably 50 times more records come out every week now. And anyone who's a DJ who receives all this stuff can tell you that it's just an overwhelming number. But yet, the sales are declining. The sales are declining, but the number of releases goes up every year. You know what I think the great thing about rock and roll is, if you're a band and you get together and you do something, maybe it's by accident. If you can make a cool record that's different, people will hear it. And it doesn't mean that you're going to have a gold record or anything like that. But it kind of gets around. And so it's not that difficult to make your mark. At least for English-speaking bands, I think it's more difficult for bands who sing in other languages. And again, it doesn't mean you become a rock star, but it's relatively cheap to make a record and get it out there.
But this was the perfect time for you to do 13 Most Beautiful Songs. It really was, because again, back to that looking back and the present. You know, I went to the Museum of Modern Art and I watched some of the screen tests before your music existed with it. And I just was with a friend and I just stared at them and I said, oh my gosh, you know, this is some of the most insanely wonderful stuff I've ever seen. So now you were approached by the museum because you had performed there. And is that how you got involved in it?
Yes. The Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, they have a you know, curator for performance and music. They bring bands in. They got a little theater, bands, dance, performance artists. And they're sitting on these films. It's one of the things that they co-own with the Museum of Modern Art, and I think they're just thinking, not enough people know about Andy Warhol's screen test. What can we do to get it out there in the world? So they in collaboration with the Pittsburgh International Festival, came up with this idea of commissioning someone to write 13 songs or pieces of music, they didn't have to be songs, and to perform them at this festival. And we were lucky enough to get the call, and I always think you're lucky if you get to work with a good director. And so we jumped at this, even though he's dead, the director. But he couldn't tell us what we wanted. But it's always a challenge anyway. It's always a game trying to figure out what a director wants, and often they can't express it anyway because they're not musicians, and who knows what Warhol would have said
or not said.
I mean, yes, it's true. There are a few. Britta said she got an angry email the other day.
Yeah, I got an angry comment. I haven't approved it, but I think I will because it's interesting. And we haven't gotten any of those,
have we? Approve a comment.
Yeah, I have to approve them. It doesn't automatically go on our website. It goes on our website, like a comment, I don't know, I guess some blog post about the screen test saying, how dare you put music to these things, and Warhol didn't intend them to, he intended them to be silent, which isn't true anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I mean, Warhol has used them with sound in the past anyway, so he doesn't know what he's talking about, but I saved it because it was funny.
So one of the things that I heard was that the one that was kind of, I don't want to say daunting, but challenging, was the Lou Reed. And the idea of writing a new song there was kind of like, you know, the man is very much still in, you know, he could walk up to you on the street and say, excuse me.
Yeah, exactly.
And having Lou do that would be an interesting moment.
Well, we looked at it. He did come to the show in New York. We actually looked at a couple of different screen tests of Lou, and they're only about 4 months apart. But the first one, he just looks like a little innocent little kid, and he's sitting there looking from side to side, and then the second one, shot about 4 months later, he's wearing a black leather jacket and wraparound shades and drinking Coke, and so behind those shades, it's impossible to appear vulnerable, and it's. But that one was shot to project on the band as they play. I think was the first one was more of just a straight screen test, like Warhol was instructing people just sit there and look at the camera, and not everyone looks uncomfortable. Right. Some people look uncomfortable. Some people look very comfortable.
But yeah, as far as writing a song to go with Lou Reed's screen tests, I mean, you know. You can't write a song for him, about him, so it was lucky that you just came across that obscure song on the internet, I'm Not a Young Man Anymore, which he wrote the year the screen test was filmed, when he was a very young man.
That's incredible. So the other thing that you've said in interviews, and I want to get into it because it's very personal to me, is that when I watched the screen test, and then you kind of brought it out when I heard you talk about it, is whether you're talking about Edie Sedgwick or Billy Herko or, you know, any of these people, At this moment, this was not the upside of the factory. This was, they were all on speed. I can't say they were all on, I mean, you can't make a generalization that they were all on their way down. But you can certainly have the facts that not that long afterwards, you know, whether it was Edie or Nico or whoever it was, that they suffered some pretty, you know, they suffered the end of their life, you know, right, when you come right down to it. So that must have been, as you were writing the music, how do you have that balance between what you know was going to happen after this versus the innocence, the quote innocence of what they were supposed to be doing on screen?
Well, I think certainly we studied each person, we read up on each person, and you're right, knowing how they ended their lives or how their lives came to a premature end affected the emotions that we get looking at them, and then that feeds into what kind of music we did. I mean, when you know that Freddie Herko threw himself out of a fifth floor window about a month after his screen test was filmed, then obviously you're going to
lose. So much for fame, right?
Yes.
But also, I mean, what dictated mostly was the atmosphere of the screen test itself, because, you know, Ingrid, superstar, the music is rather playful, and same thing with Paul America, because that's what they're doing up there. And Edie Sedgwick, it's not a dark song, it's...
I find it sad.
It is sad, but it's beautiful, too.
So for those who want to know the big, you know, the big secret, when you're choosing, not that there is one, and I know there isn't, but we can do something fun with this. Once and for all, explain to people that you know, there's no science to choosing covers. It's more probably that you just love the songs, right?
You love the song, but sometimes you love a song and you try and do it and you say, oh, I can't do that. That's someone else's voice entirely. Or it's sometimes... Actually, Moonshot, we actually tried in Galaxy 500 and we recorded that. I believe it's on one of the Peel sessions, but we didn't really nail it, I don't think. But years later, we came and did the Dean and Britta album, and with the help of producer Tony Visconti, got it right.